actually am a big fan of surfing because I see a real correlation with kind of the way I kind of look at music.
Really?
Yeah, and the whole zen of a way the surfers, you know, big wave surfing and stuff, and the way it's approached and the way they do their whole thing. Yeah, and it's something you have to kind of realize is bigger than yourself. You got to be at the right place at the right time. There's a sweet spot. You take what nature has to offer, and you do the run, and you have a certain vortex within that you can be creative. And the best surfers, the really great world-class surfers, there's an element of humility about them.
Hi, this is Eric Johnson in the studio for the Cloud Via Musicom.
Very few musical artists achieve a true signature style, one which makes comparisons to other musicians impossible. But Texas guitarist Eric Johnson arguably comes as close to this echelon as any musician from the past quarter century, writes Bill Meredith on AllMusic.com. Now that's heady praise indeed. But it's the kind of gushing, jaw-dropping reaction that Eric Johnson, the Austin-based guitarist, singer-songwriter, has been eliciting since the early 1970s. But it was in 1990 that Eric Johnson broke out of cult hero status among guitar cognoscenti and nabbed those two universally recognized standards of stardom and excellence in contemporary music. He sold over 1 million copies and won a Grammy Award with the album A Via Musicom. Eric Johnson attributes his love of music at a very early age to his father, and of all the things his dad generously played for his son, two made the most lasting impression on young Eric.
Well, it was Elvis Presley, because I was just a baby, but I remember hearing that and just going crazy. But then the next thing was The Ventures. That's what made me want to play guitar.
I think that did it for a lot of people.
Yeah.
Was guitar your first choice?
Well, I played piano when I was about 5 or 6, I started taking piano lessons, and then I started guitar when I was 11.
Lessons or self-taught?
Well, piano was lessons, and guitar was basically self-taught, although I did take for a while from a gentleman named Wayne Wood. He taught me my first guitar stuff.
As an adolescent, what did your relationship with the guitar supply in your life then that remains to this day?
I think it's like a world that's you can go to. You can visit this world where all the parameters and all the guidelines and rules don't really apply. As far as I guess it is sort of a fantasy world, but it turns out reality. I mean, it you can enter this fantasy world and it'll turn out a product of reality sometimes. So it's kind of the best of both worlds in a way. I don't know. I guess it was kind of an escape thing. You know, you could go off somewhere and just do something you really love and kind of bathe in that sound of it and not have to operate on the same wavelength in a way.
Thank you.
From the 1990 album Ah Via Musicom, that's Eric Johnson with Cliffs of Dover. Eric had started attracting notices as the guitarist in Austin jazz fusion band The Electromagnets in the mid-70s, enough to cross business paths with the likes of Nat Weiss, who got Eric's session work on Cat Stevens' 1978 album Back to Earth, and ZZ Top manager Bill Ham. By 1980, Eric Johnson had developed an almost mythical reputation as a spectacular guitarist, enough to garner the cover story of Guitar Player magazine, and this is without any record deal, mind you. This was a decade and a half before the internet, before email, PCs, databases, cell phones, satellite TV and cable, instant messaging and DVDs made it possible for an independent band to compete with major labels. In 1980, Eric Johnson's legend as a guitar phenomenon was spreading simply by word of mouth.
Kyle Brock and Bill Maddox and I would just go on the road. We had this van, and we just filled the very back of it with gear, and then we had two bunks over the top of the gear, and we'd, you know, take turns driving, and we just crisscrossed the U.S., playing all sorts of gigs, basically just playing anywhere anybody would have us. And we played a lot of rough gigs and played a lot of funky places and, you know, slept in the van or, you know, stayed at a lot of Motel 6s that weren't as nice as they are nowadays. Motel 6s used to, they've kind of upgraded to Motel 7s at this point. But, yeah, and it was just, but, you know, we were kids and we just loved playing. And the thing is, you know, it's like the glass has half empty or full. You know, we were out playing original music, doing our own thing, having fun with no, you know, life was simple. You just get up and practice or play gigs, and it was a great time. So even though we were roughing it a little bit, we still had a bed to sleep in. We still had food to eat. And, you know, we're just out cruising around playing these places. And our overhead was so low, we were able to make a living at it, which was a real gift to be a musician and get to do your own music. And so there wasn't a lot of overbearing type frustration of, oh, why aren't we, you know, hugely famous or rich or whatever. I think we really saw the bounty of what we had. Although we were, you know, I was trying to get successful, wanted to get a record deal and whatever. But it's what it takes. You look at a lot of people's history of how they finally got their record deal or how they got some element of success. And you know, like Loretta Lynn, I mean, she sold records out of her trunk.
Sure she did. Her
husband drove did. All over, you know, and it's like,
that's right.
There's a never-ending list of the people that got turned down by everybody, and they went, well, you know what? I can either take that and go, oh, I'm getting turned down, or I can go, great, fine, I'll go to plan B. You know, you see those rocks in the river where you just put the kayak around it, you know? You don't have to run into it. You just re-steer, renegotiate, and go to plan B, you know? And so that's what we just did. I did that for years and years.
Oh, but I know the trail we stopped.
That's Eric Johnson on guitar and vocal with the song Highlandrins, a perfect example of what writer Bill Meredith called, and I quote, a guitar sound as unique as his fingerprints. Eric Johnson's first solo release, Tones, in 1986, is still highly regarded to this day, but nevertheless, it received only modest airplay and sales. I asked Eric Johnson what he hoped to build upon and what he hoped to change with the next album, which he titled A Via Musica.
Well, I guess I wanted to make a real honking guitar record that just had a lot of really blow-up guitar on it. And so that's kind of what I set out to do. A lot of the songs on A Via Musica were either songs that were not... We were going to cut Cliffs of Dover on Tones, and then it was in Manhattan, which didn't come out to a lot later, but it was just decided on the certain songs on Tones, so those songs kind of fell off by the wayside, but a lot of those had already been written. So I kind of had an arsenal of tunes from playing for 10 years and kind of deciding the tunes I wanted to do, and then I thought, well, I just want to go ahead and really give it all I got to play the most, you know, blow-up guitar I can at that point, so that was kind of... I really pushed myself really hard to try to just make the guitar as explosive as I could, and I pushed myself really almost over the edge doing it.
Really?
Yeah, it was tough. I mean, I worked real hard at it, and I was really playing at the edge of my ability. I mean, I'm sure there's people that could play circles around it, but I was about as good as I could. I was just really pushing myself to get those parts and stuff. So it was. And the record is kind of chock full of it. There's no let up, you know. It's just constant, blow up guitar. So.
Via Musicom album that's called Trademark by Eric Johnson. Next, in intimate detail, Eric Johnson reveals the natural forces and the supernatural ones that must be allowed to take control for beauty this exhilarating to be exposed.
Hi, this is Eric Johnson in the studio for the Avia Musicom.
How did all that airplay on Avia Musicom change your life and how many dates that you worked that year?
Well, we started touring a whole lot. We basically toured almost a year and a half nonstop and got to do all sorts of stuff and, you know, play really cool gigs and open for a lot of big bands. And it was a great experience. It really opened a lot of avenues and opportunities for me. I was able to do the studio thing and create a situation where I could get lost for years and take forever to make records. Unfortunately, that's the downside of it, I guess.
Amidst all this wonderful success for you personally, how much will Avia Musicom and 1990 be inextricably connected in some way with the sudden loss of Stevie Ray Vaughan in September that year?
Well, I think it definitely made me stop. And I mean, part of Stevie's with me because he was a great player and I learned from him. I definitely learned from him. And people that are that magnificent, whether you try or not, they're part of your structure and what you do. So without even trying, he becomes part of my musical venture because I respected him musically. Yeah, that was just such a surprise and such a shock out of left field that I do remember exactly where I was when I found out that information. I remember the room I was sitting in and finding out that it was just like hard to believe. You know, you just didn't even think it was true.
That flows through my dreams. Aaron is the dust underneath me. Something far away, I'm a rush, so it seems. What I long to see, oh, could it be? Thank you.
That's the breathtaking Desert Rose from Eric Johnson's 1990 album Avia Musicom. The dizzying torrent of notes there in the end solo reveals such creative abandonment and risk-taking that I had to ask Eric Johnson if there was a spiritual component to making music that aspires to reach beyond the intellect.
Yeah, well, definitely when you go to that more of that Zen place where you're kind of letting go and that bigger than yourself thing is happening, and then you're just caught in that, you're just surfing that wave, you know, and then you kind of just go with it. It's cool. I actually am a big fan of surfing because I see a real correlation with kind of the way I kind of look at music.
Really?
Yeah, and the whole Zen of a way the surfers, you know, big wave surfing and stuff, and the way it's approached and the way they do their whole thing. Yeah, and it's something you have to kind of realize is bigger than yourself. You got to be at the right place at the right time. There's a sweet spot. You take what nature has to offer, and you do the run, and you have a certain vortex within that you can be creative. And the best surfers, the really great world-class surfers, there's an element of humility about them. If you hear Laird Hamilton talk or something, you can tell there's a certain humility about him because I think he's realized that he's part of something bigger than himself. And there, with that realization, he's able to go to another level of his expertise. It's a real kind of high comment about improvisation, because once you engage in that wave, once these guys engage in that wave, they're committed. They're in a situation where it's not like, well, now let me. And so if you think about it, where you jump in and you start improvising in the higher sense, it'd be where you commit to that thing, that event while it happens, and you stay with it and you write it and you try to keep it together and you try to make it make musical sense. So in the higher sense of doing the best job of improvisation, it would be the same as aligning to and committing to that moment in time that's going to play itself out.
One of the real sleepers on the album Avia Musicom, a song called Nothing Can Keep Me From You, finds Eric Johnson performing goosebump fills and solos like a violinist, coaxing an evocative spirit from his electric guitar like only a virtuoso saxophonist or violinist could do.
You know, I learned from people that, you know, like Clapton really mimicked the female human voice. I mean, that was his whole thing. The way he played was to try to mimic the voice, and that he's a big hero of mine. And I listened to and studied saxophone and violin, as well as piano, and then other instruments to a lesser degree, oboe and clarinet and stuff. And there is a certain infusion of organic, you know, energy that goes into those, and it gives them such an interesting tone. For whatever reason, and I've chosen, you know, like with the electric guitar, I want to try to put that kind of magic into it. It's not for everybody. It you know, there's great functions of the electric guitar. I think it's a great function even in really heavy metal music or alternative music or any label you want to use to describe contemporary or trend music. One of the numerous functions that I find really captivating and interesting is transmuting it into the kind of impact that the saxophone or violin would have.
Close my eyes, see your reflection in my life. You always are. Now I know my true direction, 'cause I see your shining.
just such songs as Nothing Can Keep Me From You that garnered Eric Johnson's Avia Musicom album 3 Grammy nominations in 1990, and then an actual Grammy Award for the song Cliffs of Dover for 1991. Avia Musicom was certified platinum for more than 1 million copies sold. Coming up next, Eric reveals why he disappears for long periods. Plus, he takes a Lone Star stand against violence and sexism in music. And we'll hear an exclusive live tribute by Eric Johnson to his friend Stevie Ray Vaughan coming up next.
Hi, this is Eric Johnson in the studio for the Avia Musicom.
Frankly, with 4 years between the Tones album and Avia Musicom, then 6 years until Venus Isle, and then almost 9 long years until his last studio album, Bloom, Eric Johnson has developed a notorious reputation for being his own A&R man, as in anal retentive. I asked Eric what takes increasingly more and more time.
A lot of my preparation over the years has been almost like you're jumping ahead of yourself and not really concentrating efficiently and smartly on the work at hand. Oh no, let's just take this one step at a time instead of jumping around to a bunch of things at once. And I think a lot of it is not trusting that flow enough. You think, no, I got to get in there with my clenched fist and do this. I got to do it this way. I'm hearing this or whatever. And then I think that those factors come from not believing in yourself enough, not kind of fearing that you can't do it the way you want. So you got to jump in and manipulate it, you know what I mean? Instead of like develop the muscle of letting it happen and do your own pre-homework, like to get to be good enough musically where you can just let it happen. So I think, you know, and on all honesty, I think it's been a process of dealing with the ego. And I think, as ironical as it sounds, I think there's a difference between self-confidence and ego. In fact, I've come to really kind of believe they're like opposite of each other.
Really?
When you have self-belief and you don't have the fear, and you have the self-awareness and assuredness, you have confidence. When you have ego, you work out of the mind and you have fear that you can't do something. So you've got to clench your fist and you've got to do this and you've got to like to try to hold the weight of the world. And I think a lot of my process by which I've made music has been interrupted by coming from more that way, you know, not really believing I could just let it happen. So I'll got to get in there and like, you know, paint by numbers or whatever. But you know, I just think it's been a learning process for me to kind of look at how can you make more sublime music, you know. And one of the best ways to start making better music, I think, is to take a look at what you could do to make better music and being honest with yourself. If you can't get to that place, then you'll never even approach. You can't answer a question that you haven't posed.
Bottom of me.
From Eric Johnson's 1986 album, Tones, that's Off My Mind. Eric Johnson continues his explanation as to why he'd disappear for years between albums.
You know, months would go by with these experiments, if you of a complete different approach to guitar. And at the end of the day, after, you know, nine times out of ten, it'd be like spending a month on some, you know, thing. And, oh, well, that didn't work. Let's try another one. It's like, you know, your life is passing you by while you're trying to reinvent this thing. And I don't, and that's what I mean. It's like, where you set your priorities. It's like if the intention can be good, but you have to be careful about the way you actualize an intention. And my intention of trying to be Archimedes or transmuted or whatever, that's a good intention. But once you set upon a path of doing something like that, you have to kind of be smart about the way you just let it unfold.
You got to have, you mentioned the path. Yeah. You got to have a compass.
Right.
Right?
Yeah. I just think the guitar it's been done. You know, it's been done for 50 years. And it's like, sometimes it's hard for me to get just totally blown out and inspired and the hairs raising on my hands listening to electric guitar. I want to hear something about it that just goes to a level to where it's like, God, that's fresh, that's cool, that sound, that's really speaking to me. And maybe that was easier back, you know, many years ago when it hadn't been done so much. But it's been done so much now. It's so homogenous. It's a household term. It's like an appliance or something. And to go searching for some way to get beyond that sometimes can be very time consuming unless you're just real careful about where you look. And I'm still not sure how to, you know, you mentioned the word compass, how to really use that to get right to the heart of the matter and make the most mileage out of that. But I'm getting a little clearer about it now. And I think it does have to do with using your intuition instead of your mind.
Thank you.
haunting trail of tears from Eric Johnson's 1986 Tones album is about the notorious forced evacuation of the Native American tribes of Georgia to Oklahoma in the mid-1800s, in which hundreds died of starvation and disease. Another modern-day sad legacy, Eric Johnson fears, is being left by some irresponsible musicians and rap hip-hop singers.
It's me kind of stepping forward and just saying what I really think, which I don't believe in censorship. But having said that, I believe in some responsibility so that we can afford not to be censored. In other words, I don't believe in artists that manipulate and advantageously use lyrics and messages and concepts that are very negative and abusive because they can get mileage out of it. And additionally, I don't believe that when they are interviewed and they just back off and say, oh, it's just my art, I don't know what you're talking about, I'm just writing what I feel. I don't really respect that kind of lyrics, you know, where it's abusive to people or abusive to women and very negative. I think it's bad role models, and I think it's very irresponsible when these artists, that the eyes of the world are looking at them, they're looking up to them, especially 11, 12-year-old kids, and they just want to bow out like, oh, I don't know what you're talking about, it's just my music. That's not, I mean, the reality is these people look up to these people, and they have a very rare opportunity. Millions of people watching them. What kind of message are you going to show? What footsteps are you going to walk? It doesn't mean we all have to be Puritans. I don't mean that. But it's like, what are your aspirations? What are your dreams? Where are you? What kind of polarity are you trying to emit? What frequency would you like to see us all get together on, rather than diffuse us? And I think it's very obviously you can feel the frequency somebody's emitting. And I just I have a problem with that. And I got tired of just sitting around not saying anything.
from the Stuart Hamm album The Urge. That's the song Lone Star, with the unmistakable guitar sound of Eric Johnson, taking a Lone Star stand on the issue of responsible lyrics in recorded music.
And I think that it's indicative of a lot of what happens in society. And when you wonder why kids are carrying guns, or why there are problems, or why people are unhappy, you know, or these things like the Columbine High School thing. I mean, you look at all this stuff and you can't say, well, this is out of thin air. Where our heart is, what excites us, what really turns us on. And there's a line in there that the children learn from what excites us. Because children learn from what excites us. What are our loves? What turns us on? What do we align with that, oh, this is great? Do we align with movies that are extremely negative, or pop music that's, or do we align with something that's talking about, well, in these problems of the world, we'll figure out a way to, and children pick up on that. So I, you know, it's the children learn from what excites us, and that's a sad legacy, because it is a sad legacy. That what are we going to leave? We have a finite number of years here on earth. What are we leaving for children? There was a guy named Jeffrey Shane at Capitol at the time, because I and when I put out Avia Musicom, it was like I couldn't get arrested, really. And he just came to me one day there and went, you know, this is a really nice record. I don't care what anybody says. I'm going to make this record happen because I like it. And I think sometimes we just get lucky if somebody has conviction and believes in what we do, and they just get out and they go to bat for you. And they have such a conviction that it's infectious, and other people feel that. And I remember we were having a discussion, some friends and I, about, well, if you're a great salesman, you can sell a vacuum cleaner to anybody, and it doesn't matter what you think about it. And I remember kind of being of the opinion, no, I don't agree with that. You can be a great salesman, you can sell vacuum cleaners, but if you knock on that door and you're like, man, if you have the conviction that you know and you feel that you really like this thing, then I think it puts it in a different octave, you know, with the sell, the buyer, you know. And I think I was lucky that Jeff just resonated with it, because he went around and he just convinced people, and then at least gave it the time of day to give it a chance, you know. And there's a lot of great music out there that never gets an opportunity. It might not have somebody champion it, or somebody you know, with conviction. I mean, you know, it's like when Loretta Lynn made, I remember reading a story about when she made her first records, and everybody's like, oh, please leave us alone. And I think it was her husband at the time, or guy had Phil, he said, I don't care what anybody said. He filled the whole trunk with her records and he drove everywhere. What would have happened to her if that hadn't happened, you know? Never. And sometimes we just need that one person that resonates and just goes, wow, I get it, you know. And then they make it a mission to go out and convince people to get it, you know, and or to understand. So you got to kind of laugh at the way this whole planet is. I mean, one minute you walk in one place and it's like, oh no, please, will you enter on your hands and knees and use this dog bowl over there? And then 2 weeks later you go in and they're like, oh, can I get you a tea from Madagascar, and here's your silver slippers. I mean, you just got to laugh, you know, because what's your other choice? Or what's your other, you know, you could like get brittle and freak out and, you know, oh, well, you know what I mean? And then you just break in half. Who cares? And at the end of the day, who cares? It doesn't matter either way. It's kind of not, it doesn't mean anything. I just kind of laugh about it at this point. And you watch that up and down thing, you know, one minute somebody's putting a crown on you, and the next minute you're getting the boot and you're rear end, you know. So, you know, and especially in this business, you know, it, with record people, the musicians, and the, everybody, you know, we all, it's just like, wow. I have a feeling that, like, when we leave this planet, that we're going to just say something like, I had no idea. I didn't know, you know. I couldn't know. It's almost like if we were being, like, you know, held, if we were like floating above Grand Canyon for 80 years, you know, with like a mile of space below us, you know, and we spent our whole life and we're kind of like dancing around going, yeah, everything's fine. And at the end of our life, we go, wow, that whole time we had this incredible hand holding us up the whole time. And I was just like, I didn't know. I just didn't know, you know. But I think there are little glimmers that we could know if we open up a little and we can feel a little. I'm not sure why the shroud or the wizard behind the curtain. It's all a mystery to me. And the more you
delve into it, the deeper the mystery gets. It's because we're trying to use our mind and our English language to figure out something that, you know what I mean? But so it's almost like, I think you just go, wow, there's something, you know, and people want to, you know, call it different entities and dissect it all up and say, I created that, and then go to their corner of the room and you know, say they have a reason to, you know, kill other people over it. You know, it's a sickness, really. And it's sad, but, you know, if you get back to that beginning, you know, it's like we're all the same. Like you said, we all have the same needs. We all have the same wants. We're all looking for the same thing. And we all have that same silver light of thread, you know. And so I'm thankful that I can be part of it. But I'm thankful that at least one of my eyes is half open, you know, and I'm a little bit jolted in my seat. I'm a little bit kind of twitching in my slumber, you know what I mean? Instead of just like sleeping through the whole thing and, you know, missing the whole boat, at least I think I hear something, or I think I see something, you know, I'm sort of awake a little bit, you know? So that's what I'm thankful for.
The song SRV, a tribute to his fellow Austin-based friend Stevie Ray Vaughan, performed on my radio show October 20th, 1996. I'm Redbeard.